This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with former Vermont Attorney General candidate Charlotte Dennett about her new book titled People v. Bush.
Don't put your hopes in Obama to go after the torture conspirators. Put your hopes in the accountability efforts by people all over the country. We're joined today live in the studio by Bill Quigley, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He'll go over a range of remarkable activities: his trip to, or attempted trip to, Gaza during Operation Cast Lead, his recent trip to Haiti, and the death by death penalty of one of his clients that he sadly observed.
Stay with us.
We want to update listeners on two related stories, both relating to the continuing saga of the torture conspiracy in the United States. A few days ago, the Attorney General released the Office of Professional Responsibility report and the Attorney General's opinion about what should happen with that report. As you may recall, that report for some 5 years has been looking into and investigating the role of the lawyers, you and Bybee, two of the key lawyers in the Office of Legal Counsel, who wrote the infamous torture memos. Prior to Obama taking office, the OPR, the Office of Professional Responsibility, had come to the decision that the lawyers involved, you, Bybee, possibly others, had been involved in professional misconduct. That's a serious charge. While the OPR can't recommend prosecution, it can send such findings of professional misconduct to bar associations where you and Bybee could well have faced disbarment. Unfortunately and sadly, when the Obama administration got a hold of the OPR report, they gave it to what is called the Roach Motel in the Justice Department. The Roach Motel is a long-term senior Justice Department official named David Margolis. And in other words, the reports go in, but they never come out. Not to disappoint us, David Margolis overruled the Office of Professional Responsibility and its finding that you and Bybee had engaged in professional misconduct. Instead, amazingly, he said they had used, quote, poor judgment. Think about that. Here were memos that said the president can do anything in the name of national security. He can ignore every law. He can torture people, basically do whatever he wants. And yet, that's called poor judgment. Here were memos that said torture was not torture. Here were memos that said waterboarding was not torture, despite case law in the United States clearly stating that it was. And this is considered poor judgment. So here's what you have. The Obama administration basically, through its employees in the Justice Department, what's called the Roach Motel of David Margolis, whitewashing the OPR, Office of Professional Responsibility, report. And of course, did we really expect more? Let's take a look quickly again at who the Obama administration has in office, which torturers, which people allegedly involved in torture it has in office. Who's second at the CIA? A man named Stephen Kappas, apparently involved in the rendition of Machar Arar to Syria, where Machar Arar was tortured. He is the second in command at the CIA. And then you have Brennan. Brennan, who also was at the CIA, involved in secret sites and torture. Apparently, he couldn't get the job to head the CIA, so now he just winds up working as one of the senior national security advisors for, guess who, President Obama. And we're about to have a new appointment, some colonel named Lightsu. Lightsu apparently is taking over detainee affairs at the Pentagon. That's Bagram. That's Guantanamo. And of course, who did Lightsu work for before? He worked for Rumsfeld, Myers, the Pentagon, and he's the one who set up the first set of military commissions, which were struck down by the court. So maybe we shouldn't expect more from Obama. After all, how can the OPR findings of professional misconduct when it comes to torture be upheld when the very people involved in the torture are still working for the president? The interrelated update is what is going on in Spain. We've brought you news about Spain before, and particularly Judge Garzón, the judge who originally prosecuted Pinochet for the international crime of torture, and has now been looking at whether or not to open an investigation of the torture conspirators in the United States. Particularly, and fortunately, a couple of weeks ago, Judge Garzon opened an investigation into the Guantanamo torture and actually began to take testimony in the case. It's a very, very important ruling because my belief is that until and unless Europe, particularly Judge Garzon in Spain, go after the torture conspirators, nothing will happen in the United States. This is not a symbolic trial. It's not a symbolic opening of a trial, because once that trial opens and testimony can be presented, and if and when Judge Garzon issues arrest warrants, none of the torture conspirators will be traveling very much. They will be able to be arrested anywhere in the world. The underside of that story is that Judge Garzon himself is now under personal attack in Spain, or political attack is a better way to say it. Other judges, other organizations are going after him, not because of what he's doing to the United States, although that may be underlying some of the attacks, but because he also saw fit to open investigations of the disappeared during the Spanish Civil War, and particularly some 114,000 Republicans, anti-Franco people, who were disappeared in the late 1930s. And what they're going after him for is claiming that he has gone beyond his judicial authority. The allegation is that there was an amnesty for all of the crimes committed under Franco. But Judge Garzon very sharply and smartly figured out that disappearances or crimes against humanity were not covered by that amnesty law, and now, pursuant to requests from the families of many of those disappeared, has decided to open an investigation. So what are they trying to do? They're trying to bring a criminal proceeding against Judge Garzon for going beyond his authority as a judge. I don't think much will come of it. It's a political attack, but we do have to support Judge Garzon, and we're particularly pleased that he has opened an investigation of the torture conspirators in the United States.
Today, we talk with former Vermont Attorney General candidate Charlotte Dennett. Listeners may remember Charlotte ran for office of Attorney General on the platform that if she was elected, she'd immediately undertake the prosecution of George W. Bush for the unnecessary deaths of Vermont soldiers in Iraq. The strategy was to establish jurisdiction in the cases for attorneys general in each state in the country, as outlined in The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, written by former prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi. Charlotte Dennett didn't get the votes to become Vermont's new attorney general. But now, a year later, Charlotte describes, from an inside perspective, the accountability movement in her new book titled The People vs. Bush. Is impeachment or prosecution still off the table? We're pleased to have back with us on Law and Disorder Charlotte Dennett. Well, Attorney Charlotte Dennett, we followed your campaign for Attorney General, and we admire you and respect you so much for doing what you could as an individual up in Vermont to go after Bush and Cheney and these other criminals. And you didn't make it as Attorney General, but you haven't quit. And then you went out and you wrote The People versus Bush, and you're keeping the campaign for accountability going. It's really extraordinary what you're doing. My question to you, and this was so offensive, last Sunday on ABC News, Jonathan Carl, he gets Cheney on the show, and Cheney says, this is a quote, "I was a big supporter of waterboarding." Said that he had personally authorized the torture of 33 suspects, and he approved waterboarding for three high-value detainees. And he's out there bragging about this. Waterboarding is illegal. Torture is illegal under Federal Criminal Code 2340A. It's also illegal under international law. And you've got the vice president standing up for his administration bragging about it. What can people like us do now in the face of that kind of thing?
Join the accountability movement, for one thing. It's very important now that people realize that the crimes of the Bush administration are still with us, and that if we don't act on them now, then the impunity is going to get worse. I mean, the fact that Cheney could do that is appalling. It's a sign of what we're in for in the future if we don't stop this right away. And, of course, the way to do that is to clamor for his prosecution and to keep the pressure up on Attorney General Holder to expand the role of the special prosecutor that was asked to look into certain narrowly defined crimes, which were apparently even worse than waterboarding, since the you and Bybee inside the Office of Legal Counsel had said that waterboarding was okay and legal, and since they said it in the Office of Legal Counsel, it's supposed to be sacrosanct. But in any event, we've got to keep the pressure up on the Department of Justice. We know that the Spanish prosecutors have done that, and we can't let this go. You know, I've come to realize that Obama's mantra that we have to move forward and not look backward is really translated into don't prosecute. And when you look at some of the people that have been advising him, including John Brennan, for instance, who was in the CIA and was very, very instrumental in sort of helping to craft some of these torture policies, and now is playing a role in advising Obama and the Justice Department not to prosecute these people, you really have to worry. So it's up to the accountability movement now to step forward. We're hoping that there's going to be some major events on March 20th, which is the anniversary of the war in Iraq. Also in my book, The People versus Bush, I've got 10 pages in the appendix of all the different resources that people can turn to join up, to help out, to pressure Congress and to sign petitions. One thing that always astonishes me is that when Obama came into the White House, he had put up a website, you may remember, and asked people what was their number one wish. The number one issue was to do criminal investigation into some of the top-level people in the Bush administration. And many people clamored for prosecutions.
I recall that, Charlotte.
Yeah.
And, I just want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Charlotte Dennett, author of an important new book called The People versus Bush. And she's just given really what I consider to be a really good, up-to-date description on what has to be done and how there's no waiting around for Obama, particularly considering how many of the old guys are still in the administration. Charlotte, why don't you just give the listeners a short description of the book and what it's the story of? I know it's going forward in accountability, but it also talks about what were the efforts going out of the Bush administration and into Obama.
Well, first of all, the first half of the book is about my campaign for attorney general in Vermont, where I pledged to prosecute Bush for murder. And I sort of took that off of Vincent Bugliosi, the famous prosecutor who had written a book called The Prosecution of Bush for Murder. And I sort of took up the challenge because he kept saying, look, we've documented all this stuff. We've got to do something. And any attorney general and any district attorney in any state where there's been a soldier or in any region where a soldier has died in this war has jurisdiction. So what I do in the beginning, in the first part of the book, is I lay out some of the legal arguments and also the evidence for how we can still do this. And we can still do this. And by the way, I have a website. If you just go to peoplevbush.com, you'll see frequently asked questions, which are really like, how do you prosecute a president once he's left office, or a vice president, or whatever? And it gives you the tools to do it. And even though there may be a person who's going to step up to the plate, until that's confirmed, we're still looking for somebody to do it. And, I was just running for the office of attorney general. So since I lost, I couldn't do it myself. But I'm looking for other people. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to keep up, because I frankly became hooked on accountability. I began to realize how incredibly important it is. You know, everyone has their issue, whether it's health care or the environment or workers' rights. But ultimately, if we completely lose our democracy, none of that is going to happen. And this is really a struggle for democracy, and I believe it's a struggle for the soul of our nation. We simply cannot allow Cheney to do what he just did with that level of impunity. And some people are saying he's doing it because he thinks that he's off the hook, and we've got to let him know he's not off the hook. So the second part of my book is when I begin to track the accountability movement. I don't think it really had a name for itself, but people just sort of naturally started calling it that because they had come out of the failed impeachment drive, and many people were very angry and upset over that really the Democratic Party just wimped out. they became interested in prosecution. And that reached a crescendo around the time that Obama got into office. And what my book does, the whole second part of the book, is it really tracks how the Obama administration deals with the crimes of the predecessors in the White House. And I have to say, Michael, you were there front and center. You were one of the first people that started to raise the alarms.
Well, I appreciate that, Charlotte. Thank you.
I mean, it's absolutely critical that we inform our fellow citizens. And I think that those of us who were on the issues of human rights, Guantanamo, national security, we could see that Obama was not living up to some of his famous promises that he made early on. And so my book shows the gradual shock and disillusionment of his supporters. You may have been in that famous meeting right before he made his speech on national security at the National Archives. Were you at that?
No, Vince was there, our executive director, and of course made a statement essentially saying there's no difference between Obama's policies on these key national security issues and prosecution than Bush's.
Right. It truly was a shock to many people to see the continuation. And so all of that is documented. It's sort of a chronicling of the people wanting to go after Bush and Cheney and being discouraged and yet prevailing. Now, on the cover of the book, you'll see a detainee in an orange jumpsuit. He's kneeling in front of the Supreme Court. When I was sort of out there trying to figure out who was still active on these issues, I had to find them on the web. The media was not covering them at all. And of course, I have since learned that, for instance, in 2006, Project Censored called the impeachment movement one of the most censored. I think it was the top censored issue. And I have to say that even though people may feel discouraged now because they don't see as much activity, it's happening. There are people who are still bravely out there trying to bring justice. For instance, there's been no let-up on the campaign to try to impeach Bybee, the top Office of Legal Counsel lawyers who, with John Yoo, crafted those torture memos. And he's sitting on the Ninth Circuit Court as a federal judge. This is absolutely outrageous. So the move to try to have him impeached is still alive and well, last time I checked. And people are, of course, very upset that John Yoo, who teaches law at Berkeley, has been, you know, blithely doing the talk shows. He showed up on Jon Stewart not so long ago, really just giving his line about why everything what he did in authorizing illegal torture was okay. I mean, impunity of these people is just mind-blowing.
Charlotte, the Obama administration is letting them off the hook. They could have issued a report that would have been referred to the State Bar Association for you and Bybee and got those guys disbarred. But instead, they just kind of slapped their wrists, so they're going to continue teaching at UCLA and continue on the Federal Court of Appeals. I totally agree with you. The Obama administration is like the third Bush administration with respect to all these issues that we've been going after them on.
Well, you also talk about the role of Congress, and I was disappointed to read that Senator Patrick Leahy, on a state level, sort of, as you say, put the kibosh twice on Vermont's grassroots impeachment effort. Why do you think that was?
You know, I can't read into Patrick Leahy's mind on this, but I can only guess, and I think part of it has to do that the higher up you go in government, the more you have a sort of sense of protecting your own. And maybe he would feel appalled to hear me say that. But I'll tell you, I tracked how he came up with his idea of a truth commission instead of prosecution. And it really happened at the very time when there'd been this poll. A Gallup poll had come out which showed that the majority of Americans wanted prosecution, or at the very least, a criminal investigation. And here he is, this former prosecutor, who met with a bunch of us as Vermonters and assured us that, you know, prosecution was, it's not that he wasn't against prosecution, he just didn't want us to confine the prosecution to the little guys, like the people that ultimately got nailed for Abu Ghraib, for instance. But, you know, it just wasn't ringing true to us that this is where he was coming from. It seemed to us that some of the most powerful senators, and he is, you know, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, have determined that there is not to be prosecutions. And, of course, Obama certainly feels that way. It's you know, the Senate is called a club, and boy, did I discover why. To give credit to Leahy, I did actually do a whole review of how he went after Ashcroft and Gonzales, the two attorney generals, and, you know, tried to expose them for their torture policy. But he would only go so far. And as for Vermont, we have clear evidence that he really put the kibosh on the impeachment movement in Vermont. Vermonters love to be out there, you know, leading the way. Not only did we have like 37 towns to vote for impeachment in their town meetings, but then there was this wonderful grassroots movement that tried to get a resolution passed in the legislature, which if it had passed, and it was relying on an old House resolution that is still in effect, if it had passed and called on the House of Representatives to begin impeachment inquiries, then the House of Representatives in Congress would have had to do that. And we were able to determine that Leahy was one of the people that did not want that to happen. Now, why? I mean, we've heard all sorts of reasons. It's the same thing for the failure of the impeachment movement, because it was politically not expedient, because the Democrats were afraid that the Republican backlash would come, because these are the explanations that are offered. But, you know, I can't help but conclude that ultimately it comes down to we will not prosecute our own. We will not put them in jail. I don't know.
Well, I totally agree with you. They won't prosecute their own. I think there's also a deeper issue, and that's that there's kind of a permanent government in place, and it's been in place ever since the end of the Second World War. And there's a huge national security establishment, and whether it's a Republican in office or a Democrat in office, they don't step on the toes of the national security establishment.
I think you're absolutely
right. We saw that happen. There are people outside of the American national security establishment, say in Spain or England, who can step on these people's toes. What kind of hope do you think there may be prosecution in foreign countries?
I think I'd like to tell a story, if I can do it a little indirectly. It's a story I recount in the book. I got to know or became familiar with Philippe Sands, who's one of the leading human rights attorneys in the world. I happened to run into him at a very moment when I was despairing, because this was in May, when the New York Times had just announced that there would be no prosecutions of you and Bybee, the Department of Justice lawyers for Bush or for the Bush administration. When I ran into him sheerly by accident, he was so happy. He said, "Isn't it great what's just been going on?" And, of course, the torture memos had been released in April. And I said, "Well, I don't know, because now I'm reading there's not going to be any prosecutions." And he said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "Did you see what the Spanish prosecutors are doing? They're both called prosecutors and judges, and there were two of them who are using the doctrine of universal jurisdiction that enables them to prosecute high government officials if Spanish nationals had been victimized by war crimes." And so he was feeling very enthusiastic. And one of the things I had learned from him is that you have to take the long view on this. He was very active in the whole Pinochet extradition efforts. When Pinochet was arrested in his hospital bed in London, this was huge. This is the first time when universal jurisdiction could be used to go after a former head of state. It was groundbreaking, and it didn't happen so very long ago. And so I would say in the last quarter century, international law has strengthened. And I believe the accountability movement has gone global. So there's always going to be an effort to fight back. They've been trying to, I know the Attorney General in Spain is trying to curb the Spanish prosecutors' rights to use universal jurisdiction. But as far as I know, Michael, isn't it true that their investigation into you, Bybee, and their superiors, isn't that ongoing?
Yes, it's ongoing. Garzón, who's the judge, the same judge in Pinochet, as we've said, will be continuing with that case, and the Spanish will be unable to stop. The Spanish government that wants to stop it won't be able to, because in that case, it's not really a pure universal jurisdiction case in a way, because there are Spanish nationals who were tortured at Guantanamo, and therefore there's a link with Spain that allows Garzón to open up the whole case.
Yeah.
So it's going to become very important. For all we know, you know, as you and I speak, Charlotte, Garzón may have already issued arrest warrants for what is called the Schengen countries or something like that. It's like 27-some countries in Europe. It's bigger than the EU. And anybody like Rumsfeld, et cetera, may be taking a chance for going into any of those 27 countries already.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very important development.
And peopleversusbush.com is the website that you should check out to find out how to go after these people. We'll link that to our website, lawanddisorder.org. Charlotte Dennett, The People versus Bush is a really fine book. Chelsea Green put it out. We thank the publisher for doing that. And we thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, I appreciate it, and I salute you for keeping the heat on, and I just want to encourage people to get involved with the accountability movement. Teach them a lesson that crime doesn't pay, and we are insisting that the highest government officials abide by the rule of law.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Charlotte.
Charlotte.
Good luck.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
This is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
This week, CCR Legal Director Bill Quigley joined us live in the studio during a marathon three-hour fundraiser for Pacifica's WBAI. Bill talked about his trip to Gaza during Operation Cast Lead, his recent trip to Haiti, and his death penalty work in Louisiana. Bill joined CCR on sabbatical from his position as a law professor and director of the law clinic at Loyola University. We've had him on the show before, particularly when he was discussing Katrina, which he witnessed and worked for the people most affected.
Bill, it's real good to see you. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Making an extraordinary difference. And I think the first thing we want to ask you about is, I know you did try and get into Gaza because we're pitching the Gaza Freedom Pact. Tell us a little bit about that experience and why you even wanted to go to Gaza.
Well, at that time I was living in New Orleans. I went with Kathy Kelly, who's an internationally known peace activist, and Audrey Stewart, who is a longtime activist as well. We went over there a year ago in January while the bombing of Gaza was still going on. And we went over there because we just thought people should be in solidarity with folks. It was just such a horrible event that was going on, and we wanted to get over there, see if it was possible to get in. We flew into Cairo, and we didn't really know exactly how we would get there, but we talked a cab driver into taking us to the closest town there, where we met an Irish activist who was going back and forth in some secret way, and we were really locked out. We were right on the Egyptian side of the border where we could see Palestine, see all the what was going on at that time. It was very, very strange circumstance to be in the middle of the desert there on the Egyptian side.
I'm amazed that you actually got that close, because you know, they were bombing when you were there, right?
That's right. They were bombing.
Could you hear anything?
Oh, absolutely. And it was a horrifying thing because we're only a couple of football fields away from where they were bombing. And there were the constant drones going overhead. They had some aerial balloons that were doing surveillance and that. And then you would actually see this puff of gray and black smoke that would go up before you would hear the explosion as it would happen. When that happened, then there was a little tiny mosque that was on our side that started playing prayers and that stuff, prayers for the people who were there. But it was such a it was sort of like a sociopath beating a baby or something like that. And it was just, there was no defense whatsoever. There was no anti-aircraft stuff. There was no, it was just people were literally sitting ducks. It was a beautifully clear blue sky, so it was easy to see everything that was happening. But then just regularly you would see the smoke go up and you would hear the booms, and there were lots and lots of humanitarian convoys that were trying to get in and were prevented from actually going in part because there was no promise that they wouldn't be subjected to the bombing themselves, but in part, political theater that was going on by everybody at the time.
Now, Bill, you've seen a lot of other kinds of devastation from Katrina, being there, helping out. How did this compare, if it could compare in any fashion?
Well, it was really much more. In my life, the only thing that I've seen like that is that I was present for one of my clients being executed on death row in Louisiana.
Gosh.
And to see the apparatus of the state just move into action in a very calm and step-by-step manner, and then with full force and the respect of the state behind it, pull on a switch and my client was no more. It was not a person anymore. And it was that same sort of feeling of what happened in Gaza, because it was this overwhelming force that just decided when and where and how, and there was no resistance to it whatsoever. And it's that same sort of tragic, terrible feeling, but just rage at the same time, as at the unfairness of it, of the one-sidedness of it. It was a horrible experience.
I want to remind our listeners, the moving story you're hearing now is from Bill Quigley, the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's talking about first his trip to Gaza, then we'll speak to him about Haiti. Bill, I want to take you back to Gaza for one more second, and then we'll take you to Haiti, most likely. So you were there at the border. Where did you sleep? What was the feelings of the people at the border? What did you do eventually? How did you get back home? What did you do?
Well, we ended up, we rented one room in a little hotel in the closest town, and honestly caught me off guard because I don't remember the town.
El Arish, probably.
Yeah, I think that was it. And it was a town where we were the only North Americans there, clearly, and people looked at us a little differently because we were there and it was in the middle of a war. The Egyptian government was clearly very two-faced about what was going on. They were publicly saying that they supported the people in Gaza, but behind the scenes and by actions, they were actually trying to keep the border sealed, try to make sure that people didn't come up there. We went up there at the same time as some student activists went up there. The student activists actually got stopped, and they were told they had to turn around. They got out on the highway and started singing and sat down in the middle of the highway and were filming what was going on, which was extremely moving because, you know, in Egypt, when you do that, as one of the guys who actually did organize that, you can disappear. And as this guy actually did disappear for 2 weeks, he was a German citizen, but also an Egyptian citizen. We ended up staying in one room in a little hotel and got rides back and forth with some other doctors who were trying to get across and the like. But the people in the town, once they figured out why we were there, they're very, very supportive. They were very surprised, honestly, because they thought the United States was totally on the side of Israel. They really didn't recognize that there was any real dissent in the United States that would support the Palestinians. They were very surprised. We would go back and forth at the where we were was just basically a truck stop, a little place with a little shop that sold food and some some cover and fortunately for us, a bathroom of some sort that was there. I ended up staying about 5 days. We were never able to get in. Kathy Kelly and Audrey decided to stay until they could get in. So I hitched a ride back to Cairo in this paid somebody $200 to take me back, and they drove me about 20 miles out of town, stopped, and then handed me off to another person who I didn't even know, and they were flying across the desert. And then they stopped. Once it got dark, stopped in the middle of the road, highway, and dark, and raced off the other side of the highway and ended up changing drivers yet again to take me into town, take me back to Cairo to get out. But Kathy and Audrey were able to stay, and they actually were able to get into somebody's home even while the bombing continued. And if you Google Audrey Stewart and Kathy Kelly in Gaza, you might be able to pick up a couple of their reports from that time.
Bill, were you afraid for your safety at any time?
I'm not really good at that. You know, I'm not, I don't, my wife says as an Irishman, you're supposed to have this fight or flee thing that I don't have any flea in me. And so it's not that I'm just courageous. I think I'm just stupid. But no, I really wasn't afraid. And the people were very nice. We were confused and lost a few times. The cab driver was pretty afraid. We got stopped by the military quite a few times. And actually, I had brought over a declaration from the International Association of Democratic Lawyers and from the Lawyers Guild and some others to show to people at the border that we could get through, and that made no difference whatsoever to anybody. But I happened to have a little laminated card that identified me as a reporter for Counterpunch.
And, great.
and that, when they saw that, they waved me through. So anybody who's trying to do that, I would encourage you to, you know, get credentialed for your BAI
we
reporting.
212-209-2950. We're talking with Bill Quigley, talking to us about his efforts to get into Gaza during the actual bombing slightly over a year ago. So moving, really, even the way you said it, how he was there before and then the machinery of the state, and he was no longer there.
Well, I represented four people who were facing the death penalty in Louisiana, and this was the time before they had the funded sort of death penalty lawyers that they have now. I worked with Team Defense on one, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund on one, maybe the ACLU on one, and I was never, you know, the only lawyer or anything like that. I don't want to make it sound like that, but I was the local lawyer. One of the guys that I represented, you know, his trial from the moment of picking a jury till the time that he was convicted was less than 2 days. And he had murdered a public defender who had stopped to help him on the side of the road at night. And so I ended up in the case because so many other lawyers couldn't, out of respect for the family, wouldn't get involved in that. I got involved in it after he had already been convicted and that sentence was affirmed. And it turned out that he was somebody who had multiple personality disorders, had a mitigation evidence that was a foot and a half high. The jury never heard any of that. None of that was ever presented. And he literally was one of the scariest people I've ever seen in my life because he possibly had killed a number of people. But because at the time that I got into that case, a major Minneapolis law firm came in on a pro bono basis, they put in hundreds of hours of work on the mitigation thing, put together his entire medical history. He couldn't read. He couldn't write. He had numerous examples, incidents of head trauma before he was 6 years old, had been badly abused as a child, then trouble in school, then repeatedly raped as a young man in detention facilities. And it really, once you hear his story, you know, it's almost like he was created to be a killer. And once you got to that entire point, he was able to, you know, have the death penalty set aside. But of the other people that I represented, one was executed while I was there. And he had no family, had no friends, he had nobody even there at all. I just went out of solidarity with the guy. And I'm glad that I went, but it's actually troubled me ever since that we were all placed in this room that was a glassed-in room, and the police and law enforcement, all those people were on one side, and I was on the other side by myself. They went through the process, asked if he had last words and that stuff, and then strapped him in, and they'd already shaved him and put a diaper on him and all that. And then they executed him, and then everybody just was quiet, and then they sort of came out, and it was just so horrifying in its simplicity and what that, and I've been disappointed in myself, in all honesty, ever since, that I didn't pick up a chair and break every window in that place while I was there before they did that to that man. I think had I done that, I would have been disbarred as a lawyer. But I felt really bad, continue to feel really bad, that I did not do more to try to disrupt this system, which I know history will judge as barbaric and insane and sadistic, the same way we would look back on, you know, some of the things that happened in earlier times. And I'm sure this is one of the things that the human race will have to apologize forever for being involved in. But in every one of these cases, people, nobody had a decent lawyer. Nobody had a lawyer that was, you know, even put a week into their case before they were executed. And every one of these people had a consistent theme, either of innocence, which was some of them, it wasn't clear that they actually did it, or even the ones that did do it, it was absolutely clear that they had incredible mitigation stuff that would bring even the most hard-hearted jury to tears to understand how badly this person had been treated by their families, by the health system, by the school system, by the criminal justice system, and by the world to bring them to that point.
We're speaking with attorney Bill Quigley, who is the fairly new litigation director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's our guest here on Law and Disorder.
The Center for Constitutional Rights has brought a case against the New York City Police Department, really for the fact that they have an extremely high rate of stopping and frisking young individuals, mostly disproportionately young men of color. I'm dying to hear from your viewpoint how that case is going.
Well, surprising to me, the city of New York is fighting this viciously. I mean, they are pouring time and money and lawyers into this. They are fighting at every step of the way, fighting over depositions, fighting everything. And our lawyers and the cooperating counsel who are with us, as listeners know, I mean, this is a continuation of a suit that happened in the past to try to challenge this the stop and frisk activities of New York police officers. The most recent information just came out, which showed that there really is almost no difference of what's been going on, that fully 50% of the stops by police officers in New York City are of young men of color. The defense for that, even though it's wildly disproportionate to the percentage of population, the defense is, well, you know, people of color are most often the victims of crime and the perpetrators of crime. But the point that they miss so much and that people have pointed out is that these stop and frisk are themselves 98% of the time turn out to be nothing. So, I mean, it's not really if you're only having a success 2% of the time of actually finding somebody for whom they have a warrant out or some reason to do something other than stop and frisk, then it clearly is harassment. It's clearly part of the police state of it, showing who's boss and who's in charge and who is the man on the street. So it's not connected with real crime stopping, and it's a waste of time, really, of the police officers, and it's aggravating. It's an incredible waste of time. It's counterproductive, makes people less cooperative with the police for when we actually do need the police officers to help out. It's something that the city of New York continues to defend no matter what.
Is it a Big Brother thing, like they're helping build a statistical base, finding out who's out there?
They train each other, and it's a continuing pattern of conduct to just stop people, show who's boss, make them be searched even without a warrant, without any reasonable expectation. The most frequent term used to justify is furtive activity. What the hell does that mean? I mean, that means nothing.
You mentioned interested in the role that kind of policing plays in terms of intimidation and and particularly in a Latino and black community, and I'm not sure you really...
If young men don't look at them the way that they want to be looked at, or people don't recognize their presence with the kind of respect that the police department thinks that they're entitled to by the mere fact that they're wearing a uniform and have a weapon, then they can show people who's in charge, pull everybody, you know, tell everybody to stop, turn out their pockets, frisk them, pat them down, that sort of stuff. And I think it's just a culture of power. It's a culture of intimidation. It's a culture of showing who's the boss, who has the power, who has the gun, who has the the authority, even if it is being misused, as it clearly is in these circumstances 98% of the time. It's been condemned by the New York Times, been condemned by most elected officials, has been condemned by a lot of media, but it is something that clearly could stop if the message was said from the top to stop this activity. It would stop, I'm sure about that. But clearly something is a green light from the very top to go ahead and engage in this authoritarian activity that is just inconsistent with law and order. It's inconsistent with the Constitution and inconsistent really with giving people the human dignity that they're allowed to live their lives without harassment by the government.
Now, Bill, will there be, say this case proceeds in the way that we would like it to, is one of the goals to have the police department institute more, say, sensitivity training or training about this kind of power dynamic used in the streets?
Well, that's part of it. But part of it is to just imprint on the minds of the captains and the commanders and the people in charge who will in turn do it to the everyday police officers. What does it mean that the Constitution says you have to have probable cause to be involved in this activity? And what does it mean so that you understand what it happens if you are the subject instead of the author of this activity? So we are in the process in the litigation of hiring an expert who will analyze this in terms of what it means in the community, what it means in terms of training, what it means in terms of discipline, what it means in terms of the impact and that. And absolutely, our thing is not just to teach people to be more sensitive to it, but actually to dramatically reduce the activity, which because it is, again, it's counterproductive to law and order. It's counterproductive to treating people with respect. And it's harassment and it's just authoritarian bullying, really.
You know, we had a lawsuit before at the center on stop and frisk. And when we thought we put to rest the special crimes unit that murdered Amadou Diallo, we thought that was done. And so now here the center has another case. So I'm just wondering whether it's just so endemic, the racism in our society is so endemic that, yes, you've given us some suggestions of how to change it. Are we really going to see some changes from this lawsuit?
Well, I think we will see some changes, but I think that you're correct. As long as racism permeates every level of our society, and as long as we live in such a society where official violence is so sanctioned, death penalty, you know, the other sorts of things that we do, that if you have a society that values violence, values the violence that we institute around the world, that we support for Israel, the way they deal with Palestine, and if we value violence, if we accept deep racism, then what else would we expect from a police department or a military or anybody who is the cutting edge of where the actual violence and the racism meets the sidewalk? So we have a lot of work to do with the police, but the police themselves are tools of a violent and racist regime. And so, in a sense, part of our job is to re-educate the police officers and try to change their behavior. But literally, we are going to be engaged in this activity over and over and over again, and not just in New York, but in every city in this country has the same problem to differing degrees. But we are going to be engaged in this over and over and over again until we get to the root causes of this. The root cause of police racist, violent activity is not bad police officers. I mean, bad police officers are part of the problem, but the real cause is that we have a racist, violent criminal justice system. We have a racist and violent education system. We have a racist and marginalizing housing system. We have a racist and marginalizing employment system and the like. And we just go down the line, and all of these accumulate at the force edge of the guy with the gun. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm an Irish Catholic. I was interested in domestic social justice, civil rights work from the beginning. I was not aware of the issues of Israel and Palestine. I had no way really to be exposed to that till I grew older. And most people don't. We don't have the educational opportunities to know what's going on with Haiti, Iraq, Palestine, these other things, even in our own country. And essential nature of what this radio station does to give people an opportunity to become informed about these things that are going on in our name. As I said, when I was in Egypt, people thought everybody in the United States was in favor of bombing Palestine. They assumed that the United States was totally for this thing. When I was in Europe during the beginning of the Iraq War, I wore a peace button. People said, well, you must be the only person in the United States who was, you know, opposed to what Bush and those folks are doing. Same thing when I've been to Iraq, India, Haiti, things like that. They assume that the United States is the official policy that they feel that 90% of us don't even know about. And so how to learn about what the United States is doing in our name, with our money, with our resources, it's so important to have a station like this.
I know Bill has done Haiti work for a long time, but let's bring you forward and then we can take you back. I know you recently, after the earthquake, you went to Haiti, and I know you gave a report at the center. I wasn't there for the report, but why don't you tell us why you went to Haiti? I mean, you know, we've heard very discouraging things about people even going there. Tell us why you went and what your impressions were.
I went because I have a lot of friends in Port-au-Prince. In fact, as you said, I was in New Orleans when Katrina hit and phones didn't work and all that stuff. But when the first phone call that I received when my phone actually did work was from somebody in Port-au-Prince who was checking to see if I was okay. So I had some good friends there. I have a godchild in Port-au-Prince. I got a number of reports, just text reports from people after the earthquake. And so I went down with a couple of nurses and a doctor who were going to a specific community in Port-au-Prince in a church area that had been pastored by this Father Gerard Jean-Just, who was a freedom fighter who I had helped represent along with Mario Joseph in Haiti, Brian Kincannon with the Institute of Justice and Democracy as well. So I went down there with them. We weren't able to fly into Haiti. We had to fly into the Dominican Republic and then get a ride from that airport over into Haiti itself. We knew it was bad, but the before we even got to Haiti, there's a little town at the border, which is about a seven-hour drive, which is more than I had anticipated, seven-hour drive from the airport to the border in a little town called Jimani, or I don't know how it's pronounced, J-I-M-A-N-I. The people who I was with, they stopped on the side of the road so the men could go to the bathroom, and the women said, we're not going to go on the side of the road. You got to find us something better than this. The driver said, well, I know this little orphanage in this town on the Dominican Republic side, and they have a bathroom so we can stop there. So they pulled into the town. We went to this little orphanage that was literally the size of about a two-car garage in the United States. It had a finished concrete floor, and it had 50 little kids that were in this orphanage. They were playing out in the concrete yard in front of the place, and they let the women go to use the bathroom in the back. And I was walking around at that time, and they had, I counted, 21 mattresses piled up on one side of the garage, and clearly that's what the 50 kids slept on at night. They brought the mattresses down and that. And I didn't speak Spanish, which they spoke there, and I don't speak Creole either. So, but when the woman who was running the orphanage found out that we were going across the border to Haiti to help people, she held her hands up and said, wait, wait. She went back in the back, and she came out with a box of medicine that she gave to us to bring to the people of Haiti.
Wow.
So from that point forward, you could get a sense of how deeply affected everybody was, but also a real sense of the solidarity that very, very poor people have for other very, very poor people who are targeted by this. So we took this box of medicine and we added to the medicine that we were bringing, and we went into Port-au-Prince, and it was, you've seen pictures and all that, but to actually be in front of the buildings that have collapsed. And in the entire city of Port-au-Prince, which is over a million people, there was nobody who was sleeping inside at night, because in the neighborhood, some neighborhoods had four out of five buildings that had collapsed. Some only had one out of five buildings that collapsed. But even in the buildings that didn't collapse, they had big broken cracks in the side, and you could see the undergirdings of it. And there was officially, they had 50 aftershocks already. Not at the same level, but of significant level that people could feel them. And they're telling people, you're not allowed, you cannot go back into these buildings for fear that they could fall on the next thing that happened. While we were driving, saw fire on the side of the sidewalk and looked over into this to this fire, and there were bones sticking out of the fire. It was a corpse that was set on fire on the sidewalk, and we figured it was like only two blocks away from a hospital, but it was probably somebody who had just been pulled out of some of the wreckage, and because of the smell and the disease and all the other stuff, that people had just poured gas on them and set them afire. And there was that sort of thing that you saw all the time. But at the same time, you saw the Haitians taking care of other Haitians, taking care of children that were orphaned, taking care of elderly people who had lost some of their folks, taking care of extended families who had lost this. And that was really what was going on, was Haitians were helping other Haitians. And you could travel for miles and see no indication whatsoever that the international community even cared about what happened in Haiti, much less was trying, you know, texting money or sending money or things like that. There was no food that had been given out. There was no water that had been given out. People put themselves together in camps. They call them tent cities, but that's an unfair use of the term, because most people were literally under a sheet or a blanket that could break some of the sun from being so hot in the days when it's still in the 80s during the day, but provided really no real shelter to people. And as you may know, the rainy season started last week where they had torrential downpours, and you had hundreds of thousands of people without shelter, little babies. They didn't have proper toilet facilities, they didn't have proper health care facilities and the like. And it's just an incredible story that's going on 2 hours away from Miami, going on right in our own neighborhood. The United States response to it on a volunteer level has been good, but on an official level, I think, has been very, very weak.
I want to go there with you as the next part, but I just want to say we're speaking with Bill Quigley, who's giving us some of his impressions of his recent visit to Haiti.
I got a call once I got back from a guy who was on a radio station in one of the islands, and I'm not sure exactly where it was. And he said, "Bill, explain why there was a coup by the United States in Haiti after the earthquake." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure that that's a fair way to characterize it." And he was very polite. He says, "Oh, I thought the United States took over the airport in Port-au-Prince." I said, "Well, yeah, they did do that." He said, "I thought the United States actually has ships all around the ports and, you know, making sure that people don't leave the country." And then I said, "Well, that's true." And he said, "And don't they have about 20,000 troops there?" "Yeah." "And hasn't the United States really taken over the decision-making process of what's going to happen in the rebuilding and who gets the—" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, what's the difference, Bill? What's the difference between that and a coup?" You know, he's right.
I think the U.S. is really running Haiti now.
U.S. is running Haiti, and much in the same way that we ran Iraq, much in the same way that we ran the response to Katrina, we are doing a disservice, making things worse in many cases.
Bill Quigley, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Bill, thank you very much for being on there.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.